Today is Tuesday, June 30th, 2009. This is Susan Resnick resuming an interview with Dr. Albert Johnson. Good morning, Dr. Johnson.
Good morning, Susan.
This morning, I'd like you to talk a little bit about your interest in Mark Twain, how it started, and bring us up to date.
I'll start it with my growing up in essentially a rural part of northern Illinois. I start there because my grandfather was very influential in my early life. He was a rugged outdoorsman and was retired by that time, but he was very much interested in fishing and hunting and being out in nature. And I spent a lot of time with him and my grandmother. They had a small farm just outside of Belvidere, Illinois, where he raised chickens to support himself in his retirement. There were no big retirement plans in those years. So if my parents had to go somewhere, or just if they wanted to give me a break from them, I would spend an evening, a weekend, a day with my grandparents. And my grandfather would make himself available to me. He liked being with me. He would take me around. And he had an old Model T Ford, which he would drive out into the countryside. And the countryside then was rural and agricultural, but it was not as highly developed as agriculture later became and is now. It was back in the days when a section of land would have maybe five or six farms around it, whereas now there might be one. So it's very different. But at any rate, he knew all of the wild places around the area and was able to tell me stories about what was going on and who settled here and so forth as we drove around. And he was a great storyteller, and that's the connection with Mark Twain. He loved to tell stories, and he was a sort of a gruff, hearty person. And he, although I obviously never saw Mark Twain, I have read a lot, and of course I've heard Hal Holbrook imitate him, mm-hmm. and I also heard my father often remarked that his father, my grandfather, was very Twain-like. And I can still hear my father saying, he's just like Mark Twain, talking about my grandfather. And looked like him, too. He had a shaggy white hair with sometimes a mustache, not often, but just rugged-looking man. Kindly also. At any rate, that was kindled my interest in the whole idea of Mark Twain, although I didn't do anything about it then, but at least it was in my head that there was some kind of connection there between my grandfather and Mark Twain. So later on, of course, as a growing person and reading more, I, like most people, I read Tom Sawyer, and there were lots of stories about Tom Sawyer. There were even movies about Mark, about Tom Sawyer, and eventually graduated to Huck Finn, which, of course, is a much more sophisticated book and account of that period. So that got me very much interested. And then I mentioned Hal Holbrook. As I then was in college and beyond, there was, again, an interest in Mark Twain stimulated by the recordings of Hal Holbrook. I got very much involved in listening to those. Mm-hmm. And I started in a very modest way collecting things as I saw them. When I would go out into the field, I was a field biologist, spent a lot of time outdoors. When I'd go out into the field, I would always include in the books I was going to take along to read in the summer something of Mark Twain. And so I had read quite a bit. And I, as a matter of fact, I sort of complimented myself in thinking that I had read most of Mark Twain. Mm. But in fact, what happened next proved to me that I didn't know much about Mark Twain at all. My son, Curtis, who was a graduate student at Columbia in the 1970s and the early 80s, those dates are right, worked as a way of supporting himself in addition to his support that he got from the university by working in the Argosy bookstore in New York. And so he knew of my burgeoning interest in Twain. So whenever anything came in that they were buying, he gave me a chance often to buy it, or he bought it for me and sent it to me, and I paid it back. So one of the things that came in early was what's called the definitive edition of Mark Twain, 37 volumes of Mark Twain. Mm. And it did not include a couple of the things that he wrote very late in life that were not published at the same time as the definitive edition, but became available later. So it didn't. The definitive edition was 37 volumes in addition to these later things. And furthermore, this definitive edition had Mark Twain's autograph signature in the front, and also his biographer, who's a man by the name of Albert Bigelow Payne, was the official Mark Twain biographer. And Albert Bigelow Payne's name is also in this edition there. I think there were 1,000 copies of the definitive edition published, of which the one I had was number 812. I don't know. I don't remember the exact numbers. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it's in the book. And so I had this wonderful set of Twain. I just could hardly believe it, you know. And so I started reading that, but I decided that was not the way to... This was an uncut edition. The pages were still mostly uncut. And so I didn't want to destroy that part of it. But it gave me the interest to look for the other volumes separately, which I did. So I started buying what I could, and my son helped me again, buying single volumes, first editions, of the same things that were in the definitive edition, of course. And so I started taking much more serious interest. And I was spending money on it, you know. And it seemed like a lot of money then, but it was nothing compared to what those same volumes command today. And people started understanding that I was interested in Payne. And so I was invited to give lectures on Payne, and did, at the university. Oh. And around in San Diego. There were book groups who had eclectic interests, and one of the groups was a sort of American history group, and they invited me on a couple of occasions to talk about Mark Twain. So I would give a little homemade biography of Twain. So I got to be, I was introduced to one of these meetings as an expert in Mark Twain. I had to say, no, I'm not an expert in Mark Twain. I like Mark Twain and I know something, but I'm certainly not a scholar. I think they use that term. I'm not a Mark Twain scholar by any means. I'm interested. Mm-hmm. So that interest kept going, and my collection of Twain increased gradually until I had, 30, 40, 50 volumes of Twain, something like that. Some first editions, not all by any means. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I retired from San Diego State, one of the retirement presents that President Day and his cabinet arranged to give me were several things of Mark Twain that I didn't have.
Oh.
Yeah, it was very nice.
That's nice.
So when we moved to Oregon, of course, all this stuff came with us. But it was just sitting here. And I wasn't doing anything with it particularly, reading occasionally, but I wasn't adding to the collection. I wasn't really doing anything. There was not the same kind of current interest here as there was in San Diego for that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't really search it out either. I mean, I was kind of burned out about collecting. I had collected other things, but Twain was the big area of my collections. So when and my interest, my connections with San Diego State continued during this period, and I became good friends with the librarian Connie Dowell during that period, and she had a very strong interest in special collections. And I knew the person who was working in special collections representing her. I knew her well. That was Lynn Olson, who is still there at the library, I believe, but somebody else is in charge of, I guess Rob Ray is in charge of special collections.
Yes.
And so my wife Susan and I talked about, again, when we moved, are we packing this up yet again to just sit on shelves in our new house? And I decided at that time, and Connie was leaving too, and leaving San Diego. And so I decided that I had explored with Connie a little bit about whether the library would be interested in the Twain collection, and she assured me they would.
Yes.
So before we decided that before we moved and did all the packing and moving of it, we would offer it to San Diego State. So I did call then and offer it to, turned out, Rob Ray.
Right.
And he was very enthusiastic about that.
Absolutely. I mean, he told me about it. He's very excited.
Yeah. And so we then, and just a month or so before we moved, we packed it up, sent it down to San Diego, where it was received, and Rob reported that as it was unpacked, it was like children around a Christmas tree, unpacking new things. And so there it is, and I'm glad that it's there. It will be used and consulted, and it adds to the luster of their special collections. So that's where it is, and that's about all I have to say about it. I, of course, continue to be interested in Twain as a character in American history and do a lot of, let me call it, secondary reading. I don't do a lot of original reading in Twain anymore, but I do any time or as often as I can. I notice what's coming up in other writings about Twain and try to read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of people will be interested in looking at your collection, and I know it, you've certainly inspired me to find out a little bit more. I think you're such an important figure, and
yes, I mean, you know, Hemingway once said, "Huckleberry Finn is the best thing that's ever been written in American literature, the best thing," and that quote of Hemingway's is repeated often. Every time there's something written about Twain and his writings, they almost always include Hemingway's statement about Huckleberry Finn. And in fact, if you want to buy a first edition of Huckleberry Finn, which you can do, if you're really intent on that, you're going to pay $600 or $700 for a single volume or more. Yeah. I mean, prices have gone up enormously. The definitive edition, for which I paid like $800, I think, for 37 volumes now, so sells for is listed for $30,000. I don't know that it's worth that, but I mean, that's what it would take to get it, I think.
Well, how nice for the university.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I told them they could do whatever they wanted to with it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
If they want to sell it, that's fine, but I don't think they want to do that.
No, they're very happy to have it.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm glad that they have it. There are people on the faculty, there were people on the faculty who were, Twain specialists, but they have all retired. And I don't know if there's anyone that's interested in that period of American literature now there. I just don't know.
In the times we live in now, I imagine you'd go online and just type in Mark Twain. Do you ever do that?
Oh, yeah.
I would think that there are all kinds of people and things. It must be amazing.
And there are some big Twain collectors in San Diego.
Are there?
Oh, yeah. There are some huge collections of Twain in San Diego. I remember going to a couple of them. They'd advertise that this collector was showing his collection, and walk into a whole room of Twain, you know, and I did nothing like that. But it was, and so the popularity of Twain as an item, that Twain as in the literary sense, as an item to collect, has never receded. It's increased.
Well, he apparently was so productive.
Oh, yeah.
How long did he live? How old
was he? He died in 1907, and that might not be quite right, but it's close to then. And he was born in 75 years
from
that.
Oh, so he was about 75?
Yeah.
He just produced throughout his lifespan?
No, not really. I mean, his early life was, of course, spent doing other things, and he didn't start writing until he was probably in his 20s. He moved to California in his 20s, I think, and did a lot of writing. He was a newspaper reporter.
I remember that.
He did a lot of writing then. He had had this life as a riverboat captain on the Mississippi, and some of his finest writing is the life on the Mississippi. And just, there's things that are just so lyrically beautiful about life on the Mississippi that you just kind of, wow, you know. Anyway, and he kept writing, and he really depended on his writing for not only the living, but he had other ambitions. You know, he tried to develop the first real mechanized printing press and invested thousands and thousands of dollars in that, the automatic typesetting machinery and all of that. he went broke, essentially, doing that, and had to reinvent his speaking career and some of his writing career in order to recoup all those losses. He lost all his money on the printing press idea.
I see.
And never did work out. The inventor, there was always something wrong. They would be right on the verge of it and just didn't connect. So that's when he went on his last big lecture tour was really in support of just his life. And he did helped Ulysses Grant do his biography, autobiography. And those were the ways he made money in those days. And but he lived comfortably even then. But he stayed active. And part of it, what I'm saying is, part of it, this continued activity was simply self-support.
And then he moved east at some
point. Oh, he moved east much earlier than that. He married, his wife was from Connecticut, I think.
Yeah.
Massachusetts, or one of the states there.
Uh-huh.
And so he never moved west after they married. Most of his life was spent east.
Yeah.
His western life, when he spent time in California and Nevada and the mining camps and on the Mississippi, that was all early. That was pre 30 years old or something like that. And then he started making a lot of money. They moved to Connecticut and he built this big house.
I read that somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Became prominent.
Yes.
And much more of a national figure after that than he had been. But even in his early days as a giving certain, in his first attempts at being a lecturer, even then he was attracting a lot of audience. And he was very young still then at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Did they have recordings of his voice?
No, not that I know of. I don't think so.
I'm trying to think in the time frame.
I don't think so. There was any recording going on in those years. He would say 1907. Well, there could have been, I think. But I have never heard anything. But it could be. It could be there.
Yeah. Well, that's terrific. I like the fact that how you became interested because of your grandfather.
Well, that's right. I mean, I've often reflected on that. That's why my father thought my grandfather was a Mark Twain-like character. And as I read more and more of Twain and learned of his interests, and just his physical presence, you know, the pictures, lots of pictures of Twain, of course, reminded me a great deal of my grandfather.
That's lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, as you reflect back a little about your family, I'd like you to share more about your family over the years and bring us up to present.
Okay. That's not so easy. But I said yesterday a little bit about my mother and father. I'll repeat myself. My mother was born around the turn of the century. My father was born in 1892, and my mother was born in 1897, I think. And they were both born in or around Belvidere, Illinois, southern Wisconsin. That whole area of northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin was home to them and their parents and relatives. But they moved to Belvidere, Illinois in the early part of the 20th century and then stayed there during the rest of their lives. I mentioned what my father had been and done.
Yes.
And my mother as well. She was born of a highly religious German Lutheran family. Mm-hmm. And played a very important role in the church during the rest of her life. She was a very, very devout Lutheran. Mm-hmm. And she impressed those values on the family. I don't mean to say that we all turned out to be devout Lutherans, because we did not. I think it was true of, certainly true of me, but I think it was also true of my sisters, that they drifted away from the church in any formal sense, and much to my mother's dismay. She thought that we were doomed to hell for sure. And or at least she was not going to see us in heaven, she used to say, because we were not sufficiently religious. Mm-hmm. And at any rate, she was a wonderful mother, though. She was very devoted to the family. And she never missed a chance to be the hostess at a family gathering. Was a wonderful cook, a great housekeeper. Everybody always felt at home with her.
Nice.
In our house, if there was a family gathering or around Belvidere, it would almost always be at our house. I'll come back to that in a minute. But she had three brothers, two of whom lived in Belvidere, and a sister who lived in Belvidere as well. And they all lived to be in their 70s or 80s before they died. But she outlived them all. And but they were always welcome. They were always welcome at our house and often spent a lot of time there. I mentioned the fact that she played the piano, played the organ as well, and she gave lessons to hundreds of kids. Hundreds, not at the same time, of course, but over the years. I'm not exaggerating when I say that hundreds of kids in Belvidere, Illinois, learned to play the piano with my mother. And she really made a thing of it. She would have an annual, one or more annual recitals of the students, and she would arrange to feed everybody, and the parents would come in.
That's nice.
It was great. You know, she really took a very strong interest in that. And even today, I can, if I go back to Belvidere, which I do rarely, there's a very good chance if I walk down the street, I'll run into somebody who will tell me that they took piano lessons from my mother. So she was influential in that sense.
Did the kids come to the house for lessons?
Yes, the kids came to the house. And my school years are filled with memories of... Bah,
bah, bah. Oh, yes.
Somebody playing scales.
I can well imagine, and I can even imagine having been one of those kinds of children, the kinds of books that they must have had.
Mm-hmm,
That's
right. And she was frequently frustrated with them, but she also had some very good students and good who became, not professional, of course, but became competent pianists.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, right. And she took care of us very, very well. She was devoted to my father, and she did everything possible to make his life easier.
Nice.
She was a real home person. She didn't go out in the community. She didn't party much, except with him. And her social activities were really confined to the church, women's groups and things like that.
Yeah.
So, and she, you know, I have only the fondest memories of her. She was not a strict disciplinarian, but she was enough of a disciplinarian so that you knew what was right or wrong about things. And she tended to our needs, and she tended to our moral upbringing as much as she possibly could. And as a result, I think that my sisters, I had two older than I, and I turned out to be reasonably moral people, and with the values that she embraced. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the kind, and you know, if I came home late, if I'd been out fishing or hunting or walking or doing something, and I came home late for dinner, I could always depend on it being there, even if it was 8 o'clock at night. It would be a quart of milk sitting on the table, and whatever they'd had for dinner was there. So I never had to worry about being taken care of. Yeah, she did
what
that.
What a nice base.
Yeah, it was a nice, start. Very nice.
Yes.
And my father was, on the other hand, well, I shouldn't say on the other hand, that makes it sound like he was some kind of a monster, but he was extremely affable and a friendly, funny, family-oriented person. Nothing more, he loved nothing more than to have a big family gathering where he could do some of the cooking, and people would come in and have a beer with him downstairs and things of that sort. He was a very funny man. He loved to tell stories. He was like his father in that sense. He loved to tell stories, and he knew everything about whatever had happened in Belvidere, Illinois. And so he would, in his later years, he had a special room in our basement where he had to have his refrigerator and some beer, and he'd have cheese and things down there. And he'd invite me down, or whoever was coming in, he'd invite us down to his room. And we'd sit there and drink beer or wine or whatever, and he'd tell stories about Belvidere and his life. It was a, And he'd go on and on. He knew everything. Hmm. And about the city, about its development, about people.
Did he ever write any of this down?
No, he didn't. He did not that I know of. He was not scholarly.
Yeah, so it was too bad we didn't have an oral historian around.
I've often thought of that, Susan. It's I should have realized that myself as I was getting older that he would be gone eventually and those stories would stop.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would ever really know much about them except little fleeting memories of what he might have said.
But
yeah. He was as I told you yesterday, he was an undertaker. And in those days, being an undertaker meant that you had to go out into the countryside and pick up the body. And he would, as we were driving out in the countryside, he would point to a farm and say, "Oh, I had to go up there and pick up so-and-so last December. It was snowing. Had somehow to get up to the house." And he had full of those kinds of experiences. So he knew everybody.
I would think so.
Yeah.
In that role, I was just thinking that as you said it, that you'd get to know every family.
He did. And he would tell very funny stories about them. For example, give you a couple of examples. In those days, now when I say those days, I'm really talking about mostly about pre-World War II,
mm-hmm.
talking about the 20s, 30s,
mm-hmm.
maybe the 40s to some mm-hmm. extent. But the whole funeral business was starting to becoming more rigid and formularized and as time went on. So those days before that, though, the family would come into the city somehow and pick out a casket for the loved one, whoever had just died. And often those families were poor. They really didn't have much money. And so I remember my father had a showroom of caskets and with various prices. The high-priced ones were the solid copper and solid bronze, and, you know, and which cost hundreds of dollars in those days. That was a lot of money. But then there was the very cheap cloth-covered wood ones. Mm. Then there were the cheapest of all, the ones that the county would pay for indigents,
mm-hmm.
which were just nothing more than a pine box, essentially. But my father would size up the family beforehand. And when they came in to look at caskets, which they inevitably did, he would try to steer them into the price category he thought they could afford. But sometimes the family's pride would emerge, and they would say, "Well, Mother never had anything good in her life, but here's our chance to do something for her." And they'd spend more than they should have, and more than they could really afford.
Interesting.
And more than they could afford. And so my father would try to mm-hmm. get them over into a more modest category and succeed sometimes, but sometimes no. The family had to have its way. Ma was going to get her reward finally.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it was.
I hadn't thought about that.
But that's a lot of status in caskets, believe me.
Huh.
And I remember, as a matter of fact, my father would come home for lunch and he would talk about a family that had, where there had been a death, and he would report to my mother the kind of casket that the family had chosen, and how much it cost,
huh.
And of course he was in business, and if the family could afford a solid bronze casket at $900, great. I don't have any idea what his profit on that might be, but you know, there was money involved. And as a matter of fact, we went through the entire Depression, and I wasn't even aware that there was such a thing as a Depression. We lived well during that entire period, even though lots of people didn't pay their bills.
Oh.
But we always took a summer vacation. We lived in a great big house that was comfortably furnished. I never remember my father complaining about money, or my mother, during that, you know, during
that's
all
unusual.
That period.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Now, I will say that I was born in 1926. That was before the big crash.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I'm much too young to remember the crash. All I remember is that when I was about 4 or 5 years old, so it would have been 1930, 31, 32, my father and mother bought this enormous house. And my memory says it cost $3,200, which sounded like a lot of money to me then.
Yeah.
But that was the house that we lived in. And for a long, long time, and it was the house eventually that became the funeral home, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, we always had food, plenty of it, good food. My father did a lot of bartering with farmers.
I've heard people talk about that.
Yeah. He's for example, some of the students that took piano lessons from my mother came from the farm, and they bring in a dozen eggs for the lesson, things like that.
That's nice.
And I recall one day, one morning during World War II, this would have been, so it was a little later, but I remember going out to the garage one morning, and there was a whole hog dressed out lying on top of the car that somebody had brought in during the night. Now, my father knew who that somebody was, but it was a farmer who was bartering food for services, the services being burial or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of that going on. My father should have been not that he didn't succeed well in the funeral business, but he would have really been happy, I think, happier in his life, had he been a merchant of dealing with food and furniture somehow. I mean, that's an unlikely combination, but he loved that kind of shopping and the presence of these fresh food stores in town. Huh. There was a store, a big grocery store, where the grocer was an entrepreneur who would deal nationally for whatever was in season. And out in front of the store, you'd have bushel baskets full of peaches in season and things like that. And my father would gleefully pick up a bushel of peaches and bring it home to my mother and she was expected to take care of that. Can, essentially.
Did,
happily. So anyway, we were always, in my view, in my memory, we were always well off. There was no showy sense of having a lot of money. They didn't. But we always had a car, a relatively new car. Always went on a vacation in the summer. Always had big holiday celebrations.
Mm.
So my life was not in any way negatively influenced by the Depression. Or at least not that I knew of. Maybe it was in some way, but I always had medical care, dandles, everything, It was a well-supplied life. It was expected we'd all go to college.
I was wondering about that. Well, you went after World War II. Did you go on the GI Bill?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
But my sisters, of course, did not, and they both went to college. And that had to come out of my parents, because there was no support for that.
Yes,
I'm sure.
How did you happen to decide to go to Colorado to college?
Well, that was also due to my father. He had, as a young man, probably right after high school, I think, he and his father, my grandfather, decided that they should go out to Colorado and buy some land and raise peaches around Grand Junction in Colorado, which you probably don't know of. But Grand Junction is a fairly good-sized city on the western side of the Rockies there, along the Colorado River. Grand Junction turned out to be a fabulous peach-growing area. Mm. Still is. And there was land to be had. So they went out to the Grand Junction area, little town by the name of Fruta, exactly. And they bought, I don't know how much land, some acres. And the idea was they were going to raise fruit on this land. And so that introduced my father to Colorado. And even despite whatever happened with the fruit growing business, he was able to travel around Colorado and just fell in love with it. Just loved Colorado, the Rockies and all that. And so as the fruit business, by the way, failed because the farm that they chose had soils that were too salty.
Oh.
And so that didn't work. But anyway, and my grandfather came back, and my father too, but my father retained this interest in Colorado. So when I was growing up, Colorado was on his mind a lot, and we took a summer vacation when I was in my teens. We took a summer vacation out there, went to Yellowstone Park and down the Rockies and spent some time in Colorado. And I thought it was pretty nice myself.
Yeah.
Decided then I was interested in those years as for college for being in some outdoor thing. And I think I told you forestry was my choice then. And Colorado's A&M, as it was called then, had a great forest, had a good forestry school. It was known for that. So it was a chance to combine my interests in the field with the state itself. So that's what really drew me there in the first place.
It is interesting how one thing leads to another.
Yeah, yeah. And then once I was there, I too became very interested in Colorado and spent the rest of my education years there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And during, as you got older, tell me more about the family that you had.
Well, when I was, actually, I was quite young. I had graduated from high school. I had enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps.
Right.
Rather than be drafted. And I was sent to, or qualified by tests, I qualified for aviation cadet training. And in the meantime, I had my high school, post-high school sweetheart was a woman, same age, who I eventually married.
Mm-hmm.
And I married her when I was like 19. She was 18. I mean, mm-hmm. one of those kinds of situations. And I was still in the Army Air Corps at that point. And we went from being married in Belvidere, Illinois, to where I was stationed at that time, which was in Douglas, Arizona. And where there was an Army Air Corps base there, Douglas Army Airfield. But it was just at the end of the war, as I think I mentioned. I really didn't spend much time in the Air Corps because the war ended. VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, came in May, was it, of 45. And I was, where was I stationed at that time? I think in Texas, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then moved to Arizona. And VJ Day, Victory Over Japan Day, came. Actually, I was on furlough. Got married during those few days when the first A-bomb was dropped. And then we went back, however, to Arizona after we were married. And that was August. And then they started closing bases down. And that one was closed down. I was sent to Illinois, to an Army Air Base there, and was finally discharged from there in November of 1945. So my Army career was really very brief,
mm-hmm.
all spent in the United States, all under sort of ideal circumstances, if you can call being in the military ideal in any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But and then the GI Bill came along. I still remember sitting in the session where we were given some information about after you're discharged, what, you know, and this major standing up in front of us and announcing to us that there was going to be something called the GI Bill. And he said, I'll never forget this, because he was prescient, he was quite correct. He said, it's the greatest program of social engineering that's ever been enacted in the United States.
I've heard that.
I thought, well,
yeah,
okay, but it turned out to be the case.
Yes,
it really did. And but anyway, I was sufficiently impressed by that. I was going to college anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was clear from the time I could even think about it that I would eventually go to college, somehow or another. I'd mm-hmm. go, and so the GI Bill just made it certain that mm-hmm. I would go. And my wife and I then packed up and moved to Fort Collins from Belvedere. I spent a few months in Belvedere after November. From November to March, I was working in a grocery store in Belvedere, and with the idea, though, that we would go to Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did. We packed up in March of 1946, drove out to Fort Collins. And the rest is history. Sure.
And you have
three
sons?
Three sons, yeah. Two of them were born in Fort Collins,
mm-hmm.
And one in Boulder. So, yeah, the oldest is Mark, his name is, and he was born in 1946, so that makes him 63, I think. He'll be 63 in July.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother, who lives here in Portland, Curtis, he is 61 right now. He'll be 62 in next March. And the third, Chris, who lives in Oakland, was born in 1953. So he's 50. He'll be 40. No.
Okay.
53 to 9 is the bees. I'm getting
56.
The numbers wrong. Yeah, he was born in 53.
I think he's 56, won't he? Except I'm not.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That's amazing than I am, because.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Anyway, okay. Seems like he's a bit younger than, older than that, but I guess not. Anyway, he was born in 1953,
okay.
That's for sure. So anyway, so those are the three, and we all lived together through my college years, first in Fort Collins and in Boulder, and then when I got my PhD at Boulder, we moved to Alaska, where I was on the faculty there from 1956 to 1962,
mm-hmm.
6 years, with a year out going to Norway. So we were all together during that period. The oldest of them, Mark, then left home and went to college himself. He's had a sort of checkered career, but he finally finished at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara. And his brother Curtis started out at UC Santa Barbara. Got his degree at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and got his graduate degree at Columbia. And Chris got his bachelor's degree at Berkeley and has not gone back. Well, that's not true. He got a master's degree at San Francisco State in communications. So they've all had college education, and
mm-hmm.
and with surprising results sometimes. Yeah, Curtis became... I'll pick on him because he was probably, in academic terms, he had the most successful career. He was a successful faculty member, liked to teach, do research. Came to Lewis and Clark College here when he finished his PhD, and has been here ever since. So he's been here for 20 some years, and he rose through the ranks. Eventually, he became dean of the college, which is a position very much like provost.
Interesting.
But the small college doesn't have the provost position. They have a position called the dean of the college, mm-hmm. who reports to the president. He had that position at Lewis and Clark. And then the president left. And then, as traditional, the new president comes in and brings his own people with him or hires them. So, so he's back on the faculty there, but doing well and enjoying life. And his brother Mark has had a very checkered kind of career. Mark does not believe that he was destined to have an hourly job somewhere in life. So he's gone from one thing to another. But he's alive and well. And that's about all I could ask. And Chris, who was not a really good student, but enthusiastic, got his degree in biology, of all things, which he shouldn't have done because I don't think he had the slightest interest in biology, but he was somehow taking after me at that point. And then he worked for PG Pacific Gas and Electric for some years. Finally decided he liked communications, so he went to San Francisco State and got his master's degree in communications. He's had several jobs since then, but the one he's had most consistently and is now still in is the IRS job. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he likes that. He's in sort of middle management position, doing well.
Nice.
So they've all had quite good lives. I've had two grandchildren. They're Curtis's kids, girls, both of them, Sophia and Alexis. And Sophia graduated from Whitman College, which is out in Walla Walla, Washington, a year or so ago, and is now working for the AmeriCorps in New Orleans. And her sister Alexis is a student at Colorado College in Colorado Springs, and is, I think she's going to be a senior this coming year. So there's those two, and those are the only two grandchildren from those three older children. And Mark, I know, will never have any children. Off the record, he's not gay, but he's not interested in marriage. He was married for a while, but he's not a typical family man in that sense. And Chris is gay, and so he will never have any children either. But he's great with kids and really wonderful person. They're all nice kids. They're all great. And so anyway, then Beverly, my first wife, and I got divorced in 1969. Mm-hmm. And Susan and I got married in 1970. Mm-hmm. And this was all in San Diego now. So Susan and I have been together since 1970 as a married couple. And then we had two children, David, who is 33, how old is David? Yeah, 33, I guess. And his brother, Peter, the one who's in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And he's 31 in December, I think. Anyway. And they are wonderful kids, and Peter is married to a woman by the name of Erin, and they live, as I said, they live in Brooklyn, and he works for this hedge fund guy, Shaw, H.D. Shaw, or whatever his first initials are, And David is here in Portland, and works in the development office at Reed College. And he and his wife, Amy, have two children, a daughter by the name of of Harper, Lane Harper. Lane, L-A-N-E, Harper, Lane Harper. And then more recently, a brother by the name of Cormac, as in Cormac McCarthy.
I think that's who I met yesterday.
You did. You met Cormac yesterday, yes. Yeah. He's only, you know, he's less than 6 months old.
Yes.
And so they're very happy here in Portland. And they both graduated from high school in San Diego, Amy and David. Their birthdays are exactly the same day. They got married on that day. July 7th is the only day they have to remember, really.
And so you have festivities coming up.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's very satisfactory. I mean, part of our moving to Portland had to do with our kids. My wife also has a sister here, not in Portland, but out Newburgh, out east of, or west of town a bit, little town. And they have five children, I think, so there's a sizable nucleus of family here. I don't know what I can say about them in sort of global terms as a group of five boys and their families. They've all led, I think, successful, responsible lives. They're very friendly, nice people, very family oriented. Some of them are, especially David and Peter and Curtis, very family oriented kids. And sort of in a way, I can see us continuing the patterns of my own natal family, my father, and the sort of celebrations that we had and that sort of thing. I mean, there's a lot of carryover over the generations.
Nice.
There. Yeah. And very satisfactory, very happy, yeah.
Well, certainly your hospitality and warmth, you and Susan have been so gracious to me over the last 2 days as we are pursuing this oral history, and it's a very nice feeling to have such a welcoming, warm home.
Thank you. Well, I think both Susan and I were, well, Susan's family, of course, is, she had two sisters and a brother. Her parents have died, but that group of siblings is close, friendly, happy people. And we don't spend as much time with them as Susan would probably like, but we are together with them. We were just visiting one of her sisters and their family over the weekend. And so we do see them, but not as often as we might. But they're all very nice people, very, very gentle, nice people. And her brother especially is quite an interesting guy. He's a very independent, outdoorsy type of guy and lives in Arrowhead and Big Bear Lake in that area, California.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Loves to be outdoors, hiking and things like that. He was educated and became a teacher. And he spent, I don't know how many years being an elementary school teacher. Then he gave it all up and had this little house, and he spends his time, as nearly as I can tell, he spends most of his time outdoors and doing things like that. He's independent. He doesn't spend a lot of money, of course. He doesn't have a lot of money, but at any rate, he's a very nice, interesting guy. Quite impractical, but nice, very nice. We see him occasionally because he's so far away. Anyway, what more can I tell you about all those folks? Not much.
Well, I think that you certainly have painted a picture going back to your family when you were growing up to the present, and it's a very it comes around. It's a very nice.
Thank you. Well, yeah.
Nice picture.
It's there are a bunch of kids who were my sister's offspring, and that's multiplied. There are several marriages in there, and a lot of kids, we don't see them much because most of them live in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
and a few in Colorado.
Well, as I'm sure that they'll be interested in sharing your oral history in the future.
Maybe. They might be. They've been, they're really pretty independent people themselves, and we see them rarely.
Mm-hmm.
But we are sort of in touch. At least mm-hmm. I know where they are most of the time. And but since my sisters died, both of them, within the last decade, that has distanced relationships there, because there's nothing, no magnet really to bring mm-hmm. us together much. Occasionally something, but mm-hmm. rarely. But anyway, they're happy in Arizona, most of them. Live in Phoenix, mm-hmm. which is a place that I could not stand to live, but they do. And they one of them lives in Scottsdale, and the others, I don't know, are Prescott Valley, if you know where that is.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
So now... as you go on here with Susan, you are coming back to San Diego State on occasion.
Yes. We've been back, well, it's been, let's see, we've been up here only, really, we've only been up here about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've been back to San Diego maybe 5 times, perhaps once a year. Could be more often, but again, there's really... Susan has one sister remaining in San Diego, and they are very close, and so she likes to see her, and I think we're planning a trip to San Diego probably in October sometime, and we will see Sally, her name is, and her family, but her family has moved away mostly too. So at any rate, there's the drawing cards, and most of the people I worked with at San Diego State are retired, of course, and they moved away.
Oh.
And so our closest friends are in Arizona from that group, really. One in Tucson, Arizona, and the other in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Oh.
So those are our closest friends, and when we lived in San Diego, and we have seen them occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the people, if I go down the roster of the biology department, which I was a member, starting in 1964, I don't think there's a single person who is still employed.
Mm-hmm.
And practically everybody's retired, left, gone, wherever. Yeah, I'd have a hard time getting a card game together, I think. And that's true, but that's true of the university as a whole. I know fewer and fewer people, of course, as you'd expect.
However, people all are interested in hearing about you and how you're doing, and think well, very warmly of you. So here we are.
Yes, that's true.
And I'm so happy that I had this opportunity to obtain your oral history, and that we can do this for the San Diego University Foundation, and as we said, under the auspices of the John and Jane Addams Mini Grant Program. And I want to thank you for doing this.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing it, and if it serves some reasonable purpose, I'm well rewarded.